the trials and errors of learning how to steward the land.
Every decision I made, everything I did affected something else, and not necessarily in a good way.
That's Paula Wyman. Later in the show, she shares with us her ecological education on a wild Virginia mountaintop. Her book is Bad Naturalist. But first, we talk with Barrett Klein about the deep connections between people and insects. His book is The Insect Epiphany, How Our Six-Legged Allies Shape Human Culture. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station, your favorite podcast app, or at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The great naturalist E.O. Wilson once said, "Insects are the little things that run the world." Humans have instinctively understood that, and for millennia, we've taken advantage of insects for our own needs, from the production of silk and dyes to food to, in modern times, the inspiration for technology and architectural design. Entomologist Barrett Klein is an insect enthusiast who researches the ways in which insects have affected humans throughout history. He's brought that enthusiasm and breadth of knowledge to his new book, The Insect Epiphany, How Our Six-Legged Allies Shape Human Culture. In our conversation, Klein takes us on a journey through the hidden world of insects, exploring their critical ecological functions like pollination, decomposition, and the recycling of nutrients in the soil, as well as their cultural significance from silk production to architectural inspiration. Highlighting ethical dilemmas, conservation challenges, and surprising stories, Klein emphasizes the need to reevaluate our relationship with these little creatures that run the world. Let's listen now. Barrett Klein, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. It's an honor to be with you.
This book, The Insect Epiphany, How Our Six-Legged Allies Shape Human Culture. So the word allies is right there in the title. But so many people regard insects merely as pests to be eliminated. And I used to be one of them. No longer.
Hurrah!
And it wasn't just your book, but it's been a couple of years. What percentage of insects actually are pests?
It's really a minuscule proportion. If we think about simply the number of scientifically described species, which is greater than 1.1 million species, and if we extrapolate to the numbers of undescribed species that are predicted to exist on the planet, which could be a magnitude or more greater than that 1.1 million species, a vast majority of those are serving ecosystem functions and what some of us like to consider cultural functions. And those that humans tend to really focus on or dwell on are this small piece of the pie that tend to cause us harm. And these can be non-trivial disease vectors, of malaria, for example, of bubonic plague, of yellow fever, and others, as well as those that cause disturbance through stinging or biting, or, say, degradation of infrastructures like termites with wood. So we could really focus on those, but if we did that to the exclusion of or at the expense of evaluating the value, the critical value of the vast majority of insect species, we'd be in trouble. So, for example, if we take our most reviled family of fly, the mosquitoes, family Culicidae, there are several thousand species out there that are described, but only, I've read, a couple of hundred would bother to extract a blood meal from humans in order to nourish their developing young. And of those, they have a number of other hosts and a very small minority would actually vector disease.
You know, we interviewed Oliver Millman about...
Oh, great.
Yeah, about the insect apocalypse a couple of years ago. And I remember he talked about something, and you allude to it also in the book, that we would be drowning in our own waste if there were not insects. So talk about that and some of the other roles, just broadly defined, that insects play in our world.
Yeah, roles in terms of ecosystem services. The number one that people tend to focus on, and for good reason, is pollination. So some grasses, for example, are wind pollinated and others are bat pollinated and bird pollinated. One article suggested that of every 3 bites we consume, one of those is thanks to animal pollinators, and most of those are insect pollinators. And it's not just Apis mellifera honeybees, because there are over 20,000 described species of bees out there, but flies, moths, butterflies, and others. So pollination is key. And nutrient dispersal is key, as well as soil aeration, food for others. We can't overestimate. And going to the decomposition, yes, we'd be knee deep in dung and heaps of cadavers and corpses if it weren't for this combination of bacteria, fungi, insects. And we can think about the sacred scarab beetle of ancient Egypt, with Khepri being the morning manifestation of the god Re, the sun god, even worshipped for the value of what ecosystem service they perform. And it's simply the decomposition of these bodies that would have nowhere else to go, that these insects can be most valuable. And we've used that for a number of purposes. So for example, if you want to solve a murder mystery and you need to know the date that someone was felled, well, you can look to the succession of arthropods that decompose that body and the stages of development of the specific species involved to pinpoint the time, as well as sometimes the place.
Yes, and also the use of maggots in medicine and healing, which happens today. It's not just a historical thing.
That's right. It's even growing, which is fascinating to recognize, because if we go back to, and we can go way, way back, but I'm going to go back to Civil War battlefield in the United States, it was anecdotal, but people noted that those soldiers on the battlefield that were suffering from injuries were more likely to have fevers and perish if their wounds weren't infested with maggots, fly larvae. And the reason for that is flies don't want to roll around in their own bacterial disease-laden surroundings. So what do? They create an antimicrobial environment, a relatively sterile condition within which they can feed. So maggots are more effective at removing necrotic or dying tissue than the best surgeons out there. So if you responsibly, appropriately apply and monitor maggots, then, for example, diabetes and those suffering from flesh-eating bacteria. These are a couple of examples where maggot therapy can actually exceed the best of surgeons' abilities.
Now, you mentioned before something called nutrient dispersal. What is that? And what do insects do for that?
So let's think about what a squirrel does or a bird does caching seeds. They are far from 100% efficient in finding the seeds that they bury, so all of a sudden you have a forest, right? You have all these plants. Well, similarly, insects will, like harvester ants, Pogona myrmex harvester ants, they're shuffling around all these seeds and other materials that can result in not only the planting of species of plants, but also they can spread essential nutrients through the soil that can feed into germinating plants.
So what does that say about our modern practices of agriculture? Because, first of all, pesticides are being applied everywhere. What does that do to the nutrition in the soil?
Like Oliver Millman, I guess I'm going to echo some responses that big agriculture is thinking in terms of short-term economic gains, but there are huge problems with monocultures sprayed with pesticides to kill insects on multiple levels. We're at a reckoning with big agriculture and with the spewing of pesticides against which insects can evolve resistance quite quickly. And the monocultures simply aren't economically on par with creating, say, a diverse suite of species in terms of biomass production and having a healthier ecosystem, a healthier environment.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with insect expert Barrett Klein about his book, The Insect Epiphany. Now, let's go back to pollination. This is one of my favorite areas. I have a pollinator garden. This is a movement that when I started my garden, I'd say about 5 years ago, almost nobody was talking about it, and now I see it everywhere. I noticed a huge number of different kinds of bees that I had never seen in my life before this year, 5 years after I started this. You talk about a remote region in China, in the Hindu Kush, is that right? Where insect populations were basically wiped out, pollinator populations were wiped out. What happened? And now, what do they have to do to deal with that?
Yeah, it was a huge problem for them because they decided to, again, go for short-term gains, foregoing the crops of old and trying to plant apple trees. And the problem is, if you have one strain and you don't mix it up, then you can have inferior and less productive crops. So what they end up having to do is graft on from other strains in order to have pollination. The problem is if you remove much of the habitat surrounding the area and you spray with pesticides, you're going to radically reduce the number of beneficent pollinating insects. So you lose the native, very efficient pollinators. And as a consequence, you bring in extra non-native species. So maybe you pull in lots of honeybees. But the problem is that they've found in extreme scenarios is that they have to take little brushes made of feathers and then dust from one blossom to the next, from one tree to the next, from the bottom branch to the top branch, all of these blossoms in order to serve the functions far less efficiently than the native pollinators that they had previously depended on to so efficiently spread the pollen from anthers of one flower to the sticky stigma of the female reproductive tracts of the female parts of flowers.
And what will that do to the price of food?
Well, that's a great question. I'm not an economist or an agriculturist, but I can imagine it would zip up because, or they'll have to be really creative in terms of managing more than one crop, or they could go back to more appropriate crops and leave the natural habitat more intact for the native pollinators to do their jobs. But it's really, I mean, it's an atrocious embarrassment to see humans attempting to do the work of bees.
So this book is just a wonderful compendium of the different ways in which human beings depend on insects. I mean, you say that, you know, they're the little things that run the world.
And that's actually a quote from E.O. Wilson, The Little Things That Run the World. And another wonderful quote by Robert May, in a peer-reviewed publication and ending with an exclamation point is, to a good approximation, all species are insects, which I love.
So, I mean, what did he mean by that?
Oh, in terms of documenting the vast diversity, if 1.1 million described species of insects out of 1.8 million described species of animals being 60%, that's a pretty decent proportion.
Or at least a lot of beings are insects. The majority of beings are insects. So one of the most, I mean, there's many of them, but I happen to love silk as a material. I used to be a fabricologist, and it was just a wonderful thing to work with. That was way back in the day. You have a wonderful story about how silk was discovered. I'm not sure if that's an apocryphal story or not, but tell us.
It may be an apocryphal story. Would you like for me to read it or tell you about it?
Oh, I'd love for you to read it.
Okay. Let's see. Okay. Dislodged from a high tree branch by a curious crow, a cocoon falls. Inside, a single plump larva, after weeks of eating, growing, molting, then building and transforming, is on the verge of molting again, this time to reveal legs, compound eyes, and wings. Plummeting from her high perch, the larva's quiet transition into a moth is interrupted by a soft landing and a hot cup of tea. Nothing in her species' evolutionary history prepared her for the heat that melts the glue binding the fibers of the walls that encase her. The fibers unravel, the influx of scalding liquid engulfs her, and her metamorphosis is cut short. The tea, her tomb, belongs to an empress. And then I go on to talk about how this empress, Leju, legend has it, so it could be apocryphal, then discovers the unraveling single, long, durable, lustrous strand of silk from this pupal casing can then be stretched, and I claim all the way to the forbidden zone outside of the walls of this palace. And the beauty is, at least according to legend, that she identified the potential value as an entrepreneur of the use of this insect encasement for a human textile. And so silk is a very versatile, powerful material that, thanks to potentially Leju, was then bred. Here you've got the single species of now domesticated silkworm moth, Bombyx mori, bred for millennia to the point where they're entirely dependent on us. They rely on us even for their mating, for their fitness, because without us, they would perish very quickly. They can't even fly. Now, they're one of 180,000 plus described species of Lepidoptera, those scaly winged moths and butterflies, all of whom spin silk. It just so happens that this one is very much marketable on an industrial scale.
And that's true for many of the ways that we use insects. Honeybees are used on an industrial scale as well. And I had a little bit of a kind of a disturbing sense, because on the one hand, I feel like, well, what right do we have to use all these creatures just for our use? What do you think about that? What are ethical ways of using insects?
So we all draw our lines in the sand in different places. Are we vegans? Are we vegetarians? Are we omnivores? How sustainable is our diet? How sustainable is our lifestyle? Are we considering the impact, not just carbon footprint, but on the biodiversity that surround us? Do we have a good idea of how these known and unknown commodities impact our own lives directly, let alone have rippling effects across ecosystems? And when it comes to collaborating with insects versus exploiting insects, again, these lines are somewhat arbitrary. There's a so-called peace silk, where you can stop short of killing the developing silkworm moth. Because the idea is, in traditional sericulture, you heat treat or kill the developing young so that they don't clip, snip, mandibularly chomp that single strand that could be a mile in length that we wind into skeins, but rather you allow them to emerge. Now you have a different length silk strands and the quality will be different as a result, but do you take that step? With honeybees, it's an interesting thing where at least 8,000 years ago, we've been robbing honeybees of their honey, their wax, potentially their brood as food. And that changed into, well, now we'll take them, we'll harvest them from logs that we suspend. And this is a common practice in Africa and elsewhere. But still, it's a destructive process where we let them multiply and then we remove them. And then we developed these removable frame hives. And as long as, some would argue, as long as you allow your bees to have 100 pounds of honey, if they're in a temperate zone to overwinter, great. Then you're doing that species a service because they wouldn't spread in such abundance, such numbers across the planet without us. But others would say that's exploitation, pure and simple, and we should let them live wild and free of humans. So we all draw our lines differently. If we go back to the idea of food, entomophagy, sure, by default, we're all eating insects. The Federal Drug Administration allows certain parts of insects to fill your orange juice glass or your grains, etc. But if we make a choice to eat insects, whether it's tastes amazing, as Joseph Yun, the ambassador for entomophagy, will make clear in his delectable dishes, or if we think in terms of this can sustain us as a human population more effectively than the far less sustainable cow, pig, chicken, for example, far more wasteful, then what are the ethical lines? And going back to your question about ethics, and some people will draw the lines in terms of their religion. And certain insects, for example, are kosher to eat or are suggested in the Quran as being edible, right? So we could draw our lines in terms of spirituality. We can draw our lines in terms of, I don't want to consume an animal, period, right? Or I don't want to farm animals in this fashion that deprives them of their dignity. So again, we'd all draw our own lines.
Now, you also talk a lot in this book, not just about how we use insects, and there are so many examples we really don't have time to go into, but also how we mimic them.
Yes.
Which I found so interesting. You know, on the one hand, there is the mimicking of them in the development of weapons, especially robotic weapons. But I was most drawn to the example of architecture. Yeah. Tell us about the evolutionary architect, Eugene Tsui.
Yeah, so I think the third section of the book was my favorite to write because here we talk about working with insects in part one, making them or building them in part two, and then the idea of metamorphosing, becoming them. Why would we take this step that seems so inhumane or non-human to try to resemble insects? And there are a whole variety of reasons we could talk about. Eugene Tsui became a fast friend when I reached out to him and we talked about his work in terms of evolutionary architecture. So the idea here is to consider taking lessons from nature and adopting them when designing and building our constructs. So do we want to have this impenetrable, hermetically sealed titanium structure that is antithetical to nature's offerings? Or do we want to create something that resembles, learns from, adopts lessons from nature in the most productive of ways? So he's built structures like the tardigrade house for his parents. Tardigrades are water bearers, these microscopic arthropod relatives, so insect relatives. But he's also managed to look at dragonfly wings and others when he builds his structures. And when he approaches a project, first and foremost, he asks his clientele, okay, what are the natural surroundings like? And what are our goals here? And then he looks to the natural diversity as well as the physiology. And famously, others have looked to termites and tried to learn about their thermally regulated and aerated superstructures, these castles of clay from Africa. And in Zimbabwe, there's a massive structure not designed or built by Eugene Tswe, but by others that try to learn from. Now, our lessons have changed. Our understanding of termites' structures have changed, but they have tried to adopt nest physiology, which is today we understand more porous. And you've got these living, dynamic structures in the nest walls of termite nests.
Yeah, and he's got plans for a 500-story, 2-mile-tall tower. What is that based on, and why does he feel, and you feel, that kind of architecture is important?
The urgency is to limit our impact on our natural surroundings. And we know that sprawl, spreading out, taking over the land and the sea, ends up resulting in habitat destruction and precipitous declines in species diversity. So if we can consolidate our impact, our footprint, then we can minimize that. That's the idea of urban versus rural population, but it can go to a far greater extreme in hopes of minimizing that impact.
And was it E.O. Wilson who talked about the need to reserve half of the earth for wild species?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, E.O. Wilson wrote a book, Half Earth, and his idea is to think about how we can more preemptively, in a more extreme fashion, radically minimize our effects on biodiversity. And yes, he suggested having areas that run wild with minimal modification or cultivation, and then our areas that we try to manage, again, with as minimal impact as we can, but there would be stark differences.
Well, that is just one of the many fascinating examples that you have in the book of both how we use insects and how we can relate to them in a way that can better not only our lives, but the lives of all beings on the planet. Barrett Klein, it's just wonderful to talk with you about this book, The Insect Epiphany, and I just loved reading it. And lots of great illustrations as well.
Oh, that was so much fun. And that was half the battle, half the challenge, reaching out to all these artists, scientists, engineers, and others in order to assemble what I would hope could become a vibrant visual display of these relationships we've harbored with our insect neighbors.
Thank you again.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Barrett Klein is professor of biology at the University of Wisconsin, where he teaches all about insects, Go to writersvoice.net for links to illustrations from The Insect Epiphany and an audio excerpt from the book. Klein's website is pupating.org. Next up, we talk with the Bad Naturalist. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to listen again, like, and subscribe to the podcast. When writer Paula Wyman climbed to a peak in the foothills of the Blue Ridge Mountains in search of an empty nester home in the country, her plans for a tidy backyard ecology project quickly morphed into a massive endeavor. just as quickly she discovered how little she knew about hands-on conservation work. In her memoir, Bad Naturalist, Wyman chronicles her struggles with conflicting advice from experts, an influx of invasive species, delayed plans, and the occasional rattlesnake. But none of that dampened her passion for protecting her wild mountaintop. We spoke with her in December. Paula Wyman, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
You had never even been much of a gardener, much less a naturalist, before you decided to buy a beautiful piece of land and create a meadow. But it grew into a much larger project. In fact, you were inspired by Isabella Tree, who we interviewed in 2020.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, about her book, Wilding. Why did you decide to take on this project?
That's a great question. I was not a gardener, as you point out, but I was always very into nature. As a kid, I was the one who let the bugs crawl on their arms and was always just getting down with my magnifying glass and looking at things and wanting to know what they were doing, following ants and things like that. And even as I got a little older, I would try to save animals that I thought were in trouble, even if they weren't. So I sort of carried this interest into adulthood, but more focused on wildlife and insects and birds and so on, as opposed to plants. I didn't have much success with plants. Once I moved to the suburbs, I realized it seemed like everyone around me was gardening, so I should garden. And I really tried valiantly, but everything I planted it might grow once, but it wouldn't come back. And it was just a very frustrating endeavor. So I stuck with my interest in animals and insects, though. And I had this idea because our kids were launched, basically they're in their 20s now. And we had for a long time decided that we wanted to move out to the countryside, you know, at that time. So we were looking around and I had this picture in my mind of I'd plant a small meadow. I thought for sure I'd be more successful at that. I don't know why. but I had it in my mind, and I had been reading about rewilding with Isabella Tree's book about restoring or returning to nature over 3,000 acres of farm in England. I'd been reading about the homegrown national park movement, Doug Tallamy's book, Nature's Best Hope, and returning, you know, part of your suburban lawn to native plants. So I was really interested in all of that, even though I didn't know a lot about plants. But I had this vision of myself as a writer with this little like shed-like studio in the middle of a beautiful field of flowers. Yeah, really, really ridiculous, right? So, but that's what I was thinking. And then we came to this place just to see the view. We thought we were here to see the view anyway. There was no real road that went all the way up. It was basically rocks and roots, and we hiked up. And there was one path mode through this field where everything was over my head. And when we got to this one high point and looked out, we saw these rolling hills of yellow flowers as far as I could see. And in the background, these small mountains, the Piedmonts, and one in the other direction, the Blue Ridge. And it was just, you know, there were bees buzzing everywhere. There were birds singing. It was hot. It was August. And these flowers that were like 6-7 feet tall all around me. And it was so overwhelming in a good way. I just thought, what was I thinking about this tiny patch of meadow that I was going to plant when, look, there are these rolling acres of old fields right in front of me. I wonder if these fields are healthy. I wonder what I could do here. This, you know, I had the Isabella Tree project in mind. I'm thinking, what if I could do something like that here? Wouldn't that be exciting? And oh, you know, I could really make a difference. And I just, at that moment, just decided, well, that's what I want to do. Forget about the tiny meadow. I want to figure out what's going on here and see what I can do here. Leaving aside the entire problem that I didn't know anything about plants, I wasn't good with plants. My husband is good with plants, thankfully, very good with plants, but I am not good with plants. And I didn't even know what questions to ask. I didn't know whether those yellow plants were good or bad. And that was my first sort of deep dive with this place. But that's what I do. I get hooked on something and I become preoccupied with it. And I could tell from the start that this was going to be my preoccupation for an indefinite period of time, endlessly.
And it's over 200 acres, which is a huge amount. Now, tell us, were those yellow plants good or bad?
That's a great question. Well, the person who brought us up to see the view told me they were bad. He called them stickweed. And he said the bane of every farmer, and you know, it's hard to get rid of it. Cattle can't eat it, so you don't want it in your pasture and all that. And I was like, oh no, this is horrible. And this whole the open meadow of like 75 acres, that was the main thing I could see everywhere, these yellow flowers. Now, if I had paid attention in that moment, I would have noticed that bees were going to them, butterflies were going to them, birds were going to them, but that didn't occur to me until later. So I went home and I thought, oh my goodness, the first thing I have to do is get rid of these yellow plants. And I started looking. And of course, the first thing that Google told me was that these plants were a pain. They invaded pastures and they weren't food plants and they were no good. So then I called, I can't remember which organization I called at that point, but it may have been a garden-focused organization. They were like, well, you can spray them, but they're perennials, so they'll keep coming back. I was like, oh my God, I can't imagine spraying all of these. Oh my gosh, that's horrible. And then I thought, you know, I thought about those bees, and I thought, maybe I'm asking the wrong question. And that's what so much of this project was about, was getting to the right question and getting to the people who knew the answers that made sense for what I was hoping to do. Once I asked the right question, I found out that these were native wildflowers. They're called yellow crown beard, and they are aggressive. But the fact that they could grow in an old hay field surrounded by dense hay grasses and fescues and all of these other plants was good, because a lot of native plants wouldn't be able to grow in those conditions. They wouldn't be able to like fight the other plants around them to get to the light, to get water and so on. And these plants were successful because they could do that. So in a place like this, they're really not a problem. You might not want them in your pasture, but here they're good. You know, they bloom late season, August and September, and they feed those late pollinators. They feed birds. Birds eat the seeds in the fall and winter. And I can tell you the seeds are all over my dog too. So that was my first experience learning that you could get a different answer depending on your goals, and that one plant could mean very different things to different people depending on what those goals were.
As you write, a farmer's weed is your wildflower.
Yeah.
So it was already wild. Why did you feel like you had to do more?
Well, there was also, unfortunately, a very big contingent of invasive plants. And invasive plants are plants that were brought here from usually another continent. And some of them were planted intentionally by the Forest Service or the old Soil Conservation Service when they were trying to, for instance, kudzu is a great example. Kudzu was planted intentionally all over the South. They even paid farmers to plant it, because the soil had been so depleted by cotton, by poor farming approaches to growing cotton and overusing the soil. So they were trying to, the kudzu was high in certain nutrients and they thought it would replenish the soil. Well, it basically took over the entire South. And what happens when a plant like that takes over is it pushes out the native plants that actually feed local wildlife and pollinators. And then those insects and insects can't find food. They die. The birds then have nothing to feed their nestlings because the birds need insects and caterpillars to feed their nestlings. The birds go into decline, and you have a whole sort of ecosystem, you know, domino effect. And so it's really important to manage these invasive plants. And they're difficult to manage for a number of reasons. They don't have the predators that they have in their, you know, in their home habitat. So they didn't necessarily bring with them the insects and funguses and so on that will keep them in check at home. So they don't have anything to stop them. The local wildlife has not evolved with them the way it evolves with native plants. So native plants and native wildlife and pollinators evolved together over, you know, thousands of years, and they evolved to support each other and keep each other in check. So there was nothing to do that with these invasive plants. And they also, because they have all those predators back home, they developed all these different ways to reproduce. So for instance, stilt grass, it can seed from the top of the plant. So people think, well, if we just cut it, that'll solve the problem. But it also seeds lower on the stalk. And the more you cut it, the lower that lower seed will learn to emerge. So unless you cut it all the way literally to the ground so that you see dirt, it's just going to keep coming back. And the seeds that it drops will live in the soil for like 7 years. And the other way it reproduces is when it gets really tall and it flops over, the top of it will root in the soil and grow. And basically almost every single plant that's invasive plant that becomes successful here, that becomes aggressive enough to be successful, has those multiple ways of reproducing, that lack of predators. And some of them even release repellent chemicals into the soil, which is called allelopathy, or an allelopathic plant releases chemicals into the soil that prevent other plants from growing around it. So in this way, yeah, they expand their range.
Yeah, I was so interested to hear that the autumn olive is one of those plants that will inhibit other plants from growing, because I had actually a very well-behaved autumn olive that didn't seem to propagate, at least near me, but someone pointed out that birds could gather the seeds. It probably didn't do that on my land because I live in with pretty sandy soil. So I did cut it down, and then, like a good doobie, I planted a native red bud just a couple of weeks ago, right next to, because I did not take out the roots of the autumn olive. I mean, that would have been pretty tough for me to do. Mm-hmm. And I just realized from reading your book that you have to be very careful, which I think is the point of this wonderful book, Bad Naturalist, One Woman's Ecological Education on a Wild Virginia Mountaintop, Paula Wyman, that you have to be very careful. It's not just easy as planting something else. There are lots of unintended consequences. There are lots of, you know, difficult choices to make. So address that issue.
Well, that is an issue, because that was one of the things that was a real learning experience for me, because every decision I made, everything I did affected something else, and not necessarily in a good way. I had to think about, for instance, the autumn olive. Well, the thing to do with autumn olive is when you cut it to immediately paint the stump with some kind of herbicide, and then it will die, hopefully. But if you don't, it'll grow back, and it'll grow back tougher, and it will also send out new shoots. So that's the autumn olive. But things that happened, you know, I would take out one plant and think, oh, great, I did a great job. And then I'd come back and find something bad growing where it was, because the invasive plants really like disturbed soil. So that was something I had to constantly keep up with. And there are certain plants here that I have to manage that are mixed in with the other plants in the meadow, like vines, honeysuckle, non-native honeysuckle is pretty aggressive. And there's a flower called the spotted knapweed that's very aggressive. And but it grows mixed in with other things. You can't just go and you can't pull it. You can't pull something that's, you know, covering 5 acres. and I didn't want to spray the whole meadow when there were good things in the meadow. I'm really hesitant about pesticides. But you also can't sort of target spray each individual flower when it's growing in this massive tangle of plants, because you'll kill other things. So then I had to make these decisions, like what was I willing to sacrifice for, you know, possibly managing these plants that are really also going to keep coming back. So what I ended up doing, at least some of the time, I would focus on trying to keep the plants I didn't want out of new places. So if I saw, you know, a little patch developing a mile a minute vine, say, which is a vine that grows 6 inches a day, and unfortunately took over some fields here.
After you took out the autumn olive.
Yes, yes, yes. It was a nightmare. It was a total nightmare. That's really when I thought I was a bad naturalist. I was a total failure. I had made things worse. And now what I do when I see that mile a minute growing in a new place, which happens frequently, I focus on that place, pulling it from that place, because there are some things that are just, there was one conservation restoration ecologist who told me that he hasn't seen a single property in this area that didn't have that vine. And that just tells you how widespread the problem is.
So reading this book, Bad Naturalist, you know, made me think about how you really, you know, they say you can't go home again. You can't restore the land to a pristine state if you even knew what that state was. You write that the land was shaped by hundreds of years of human interference, and it will require a different kind of human interference in order to thrive. What are some of the basic principles that you learned about the kind of human interference that is necessary to restore these landscapes to health?
That's a great question. It really depends. I guess the first question to ask when you're thinking about doing something like this on any scale, even on a very small scale, is what have you got? What do you have now? Because that's the thing you're most likely to see more of. And as far as, I guess what I'm trying to say is you can't control what's already there. So you have to sort of let go of the idea of control. And instead, the word management is the word that I like to think of. The kind of human interference that is good is managing for the plants that will help the local ecosystem. So local birds, insects, pollinators, wildlife, the creatures that support the ecosystem that need to be there, maybe creatures that are in decline. So you might decide, for instance, that you want more bumblebees, native bumblebees, or other native bees to come to your property. So then you would pay special attention to the kinds of plants that those bees need and try to have plants that will flower early, you know, early and late, so that when the bees first emerge, there's something for them to come to. But the kind of human interference that's bad is to just go in kind of a scorched earth approach and say, I'm going to take everything out before even knowing what you have. I think that the first step is always finding out what you have and managing for the things that are not good managing to try to reduce the things that are not good while trying to coax and encourage the things that are good. Depending where you are, you might have a lot of good stuff in the seed bank, but you also might have a lot of bad stuff. In the seed bank, what I mean is under the soil waiting to grow. And that was the kind of thing that I found out just by accident. When I'd pull something, I'd see what would grow afterwards. And that's a slow process. It's all a slow process. And I'm not patient. And I think probably a lot of humans aren't patient. So we like things to happen quickly, but it's not going to happen quickly. It's a years long endeavor. One thing that can happen quickly though, is pulling some weeds, and the next season you'll see what happens, or planting one plant, and the next season you'll see pollinators coming to it.
You know, I was very interested to read about your voles because I live in the middle of a white oak forest.
Oh, wow.
Your book really helped me to really appreciate that. But I also have a garden where I grow food, and I'm plagued by voles. And I guess I'm so grateful to you because now I realize what an important place these voles do play in my ecosystem. I mean, I can still keep them out of my garden beds, you know, or I can lay down hardware cloth underneath those beds and keep them off the plants. But now I feel much more friendly toward them. So talk about the entanglement of life, not just the bees and the, you know, insects and plants and birds, but also other kind of life, how it all works together. And maybe take that example of the white oak.
Oh, I'm so happy to hear that you live among lots of white oaks. They are in decline. And part of the reason for that is part of that entanglement that you talked about. We have too many deer. Certainly, I have too many deer on this mountain. And in general, in the East, we have too many deer, white-tailed deer. And they prefer to eat white oak acorns. And when they run out of food in the winter and they start eating woody growth like tree seedlings, they'll eat the white oak seedlings first because they taste good. Red oak acorns don't taste as good as white oak acorns, and apparently the seedlings are also. So what happens when you have too many deer is the oaks have trouble regenerating because they're getting eaten, which is why the voles, and in Doug Tallamy's book, he mentions the blue jays, do something similar. They hide the acorns to eat later, and then some large percentage of the time they forget where they put them. So they grow. And the other thing the voles do is there's a weevil that infiltrates the acorn as it develops, and the voles like to collect those acorns that have the weevil larvae in them to save for winter protein. And they'll move them far away from the tree and eat them. So if they're moved away from the tree, they're much less likely to be able to complete their life cycle, have an adult weevil come back to the tree and kill more acorns. And the reason the white oak is so important, it's what we call a keystone species, which is sort of the linchpin in the ecosystem. Without it, a lot of things would fall apart. The white oak, or the oak, supports over 500 species of pollinators. But also those acorns feed lots of wildlife all winter long. I can't remember how many species, but there are a lot of species that eat those acorns, not just deer and not just voles. And without the white oak and the voles, without the voles supporting the white oak, you also wouldn't have bourbon, which I mentioned in my book.
Well, I also am plagued by deer, and I actually put up a deer fence. What I've noticed is that so many new plants have come up. I've got new sassafras growing, and of course I do have new white oak growing.
You know what? I didn't mention the other plants in the understory, but that's a really good point, that the deer eat native plants for that same reason that I was saying earlier about native wildlife having evolved with the plants that are in their habitat, and they support each other. So the deer will eat the native plants and they will leave the non-native plants. And that's how stilt grass, for instance, and garlic mustard, those don't get eaten by deer, and they can take over the forest understory and push out those other native plants you were talking about. And the other thing that happens is animals will carry the seeds on their bodies and distribute them, the seeds for those invasive plants.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I'm talking with writer Paula Wyman about her wonderful memoir of learning to be the steward of a wild Virginia mountaintop, Bad Naturalist. In the category of unintended consequences or making decisions that if you don't know what you're doing, there's a problem, I was so interested to read about milkweed. Now, we know that milkweed, many of us know that the monarch butterfly is in steep decline, and milkweed is the only plant that it eats. So many, many people plant milkweed in their yards, but you point out that milkweed plants in nurseries may have been sprayed with pesticides and fungicides. So what's the problem there, and what should people do?
Yeah, that was a pretty shocking study. There was a study that tested plants from a number of different nurseries around the country and found that most of them had been treated with chemicals that can actually kill the insects that the milkweed is supposed to be there to be beneficial for. And really, the only thing you can do is ask. You have to ask questions. And, you know, when you go to a nursery or a garden center to buy a plant, you need to ask whether it's been sprayed before it got there. And if they don't know, I don't know. If they don't know, then I wouldn't buy it, honestly, because it's very counterproductive. The other thing I would say about milkweed is, of course, the caterpillar of the monarch butterfly eats the milkweed. But the butterfly, the adult butterfly, needs other plants for nectar. And if you plant goldenrod and aster, those are two of the plants they really like. If you plant goldenrod and aster in the same vicinity as your milkweed, you'll also get a lot more monarchs.
So that's the kind of knowledge that I think is so important, and why your book, which is written for a lay audience, gives the kind of understanding. I mean, we can't all be naturalists, but we can all step outside of the frame, you know, that we've grown up with, to realize that observation is the most important thing, as you pointed out before. So this has been, what, 7 years since you started?
Oh, just not quite 4 years.
So what have you accomplished in 4 years, and what do you have yet to accomplish?
Sometimes it feels like there's so much. Well, there is so much to do. I think one thing I've been working on is reducing the number of invasive trees. There were three major, well, the shrub, autumn olive. We've done a really good job reducing the number of autumn olives. And ailanthus tree, or the tree of heaven, which is also a host for the spotted lanternfly, which some people may know about, and a tree called the Polonia or princess tree. Those are three very prolific invasive trees that can cause problems for the other plants around them. And trees like that are maybe low-hanging fruit in a way, because you can treat them directly and you don't have to hurt anything else in the process. As long as you do it the right way, there's no danger of killing other things that you don't want to kill. So the trees, I think I've made good progress on. I've done some burning in the meadow, which has been a big deal for encouraging native plants in the meadow, because native plants here are, what's the word I'm looking for?
Fire adapted?
Yes, thank you. They're fire adapted. So some of them will even do better, produce more seeds, produce more fruit in the presence of fire. And most non-native plants here, that's not the case. It would be the opposite. So I've had some success with fire. I've had some success managing the larger influxes of non-native plants that are very aggressive, like the mile-a-minute vine. It's a constant effort to keep things in check. Oh, but the other thing we've done, we just got 2 American kestrel nest boxes. So the mountain is going to be part of a study that's part of a grassland bird initiative, because grassland birds are in steep decline, and because of things like pesticides and development. And they're monitoring the population of American kestrel. The kestrel is a small raptor that uses meadow type areas to find prey. They like voles. They like to eat voles. We have a lot of food for them. So they're going to monitor these 2 nest boxes, and hopefully I'll see some kestrel activity this spring. I also put in bluebird boxes because bluebirds had been in decline, and I did have nesting pairs of bluebirds in those boxes this past spring. So little by little, it always feels like 1 step forward, 2 steps back, because then I'll see the mile a minute in a new place, or I'll see, you know, Japanese honeysuckle where I thought it was under control, getting out of control again, or I'll see new ailanthus trees. So it's constant and never ending. And that's the way it's going to be.
How does it make you feel to be this kind of a steward of the land?
I get up every day feeling excited and inspired, and like I'm doing something that's important, in that if the land just sat here and was unmanaged, it would become a bad thing for all of the surrounding lands, the valley, because things start on top of the mountain and they work their way down. So what I'm doing up here, I hope will have impact elsewhere as well. And I'm hoping to bring back a lot of the native birds, or to increase the population of native birds that are in decline, that might like this meadow and shrubland habitat. But I feel a responsibility, and it's a responsibility I welcome. And I also feel like I've always been a deeply curious person, and it's just being out here and exploring satisfies that deep curiosity. It's like an endless well of discoveries.
Well, that's really beautiful. And I have to say, I thoroughly enjoyed reading this book. It's so engagingly written. It has so much information in it for somebody who would like to take on that kind of responsibility, or even just know about it. But it's written in such an engaging way. It's a pleasure to read. So thank you, Paula Wyman, for writing this book, Bad Naturalist, and for talking with us here.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
You can find out more about Paula Wyman's journey toward becoming a better naturalist at her website, Paula Wyman, WHYMAN.com. And you can also sign up there for her newsletter. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.